And I sent one of these papers to the CEO, well-published academics, and I said, hey, what do you think about this new architecture, these benchmarks? And he was basically like, I don't know, man, like, I just do sales. So I saw that text, I was like, damn, this guy's good. This is what I want to see.
Hello, everyone. Today's guest is Nathan Benach, general partner at Airstreet Capital, an investment firm investing in AI startups. When asking around in a European ecosystem, his name came across several times as a thought leader in the AI space. I highly recommend you read the State of AI report, which he co-authors. It's an in-depth report of about 100 pages long across research, industry, politics, and safety. You can find the link in the show notes. Prior to founding Airstreet Capital, he was a scientist in residence at a German investment firm Point Nine for about 6 years. During this episode, we discuss his motivation to start Airstreet Capital in 2019 and how there are few to none VCs focusing exclusively on AI for startups. We talk about the power of AI models to make predictions across data sets and the increasing gap between academia and industry labs. We also discuss why AI should be on top of the political agenda and what does an AI for startup look like. On another note, I've listened to the feedback that many of you gave to shorten the length of the ads. So going forward, I will try to keep them at 30 seconds, maximum 1 minute. Your feedback is highly appreciated, and I'm very grateful that you enjoy the show and you push me to make it better. So here's a 30-second slot for our sponsor, and then the conversation with Nathan kicks in. I appreciate you. Thank you. This episode is brought to you by Rose, the spreadsheet where data comes to life. Connected with your business data and delightful to share, Rose is how teams work with numbers and share their results. Head to rose.com/ventureeurope and find out how you can easily manage your cap table, plan your next fundraising round, or import data from your favorite tools. I already moved my spreadsheet to Rose, and you can too. See for yourself how you can make your data come to life for free and visit rose.com/ventureeurope, that is ROWS.com/ventureeurope. I have already prepared some templates like cohort analysis, fundraising tracker, and cap table management, which I'm sure you'll find useful.
Yeah, this has probably been like the most hectic, I would say, like 12 months of just trying to keep abreast of what the hell's going on. Just even just for myself, and then for my friends, and then for family, and then for investors, and all sorts of other personas who want to get clued up. So yeah, just learning as we go. It's very exciting.
And what is going on?
So I think the chronology I would give is last summer, maybe a bit before last summer. So there was that huge M&A of Figma and Adobe, which I think returned like some of the most significant capital flows back to their investors. Obviously got a lot of VCs excited again about SaaS in this downturn and then design software. Then in the summer, Stability AI launches and then publishes their text-to-image model Stable Diffusion. And, you know, first real viral consumer-grade experience for experiencing the capabilities of AI systems in a way that produces basically magic or like black magic. And then that governed Twitter for at least a couple of weeks or a couple of months. Then coupled with that, like the downturn in crypto and the downturn in broader markets, I think a lot of folks are trying to figure out what is like the next big thing to work on that, you know, attracted, I think, a lot of like VC interest kind of pivoting into the space. And I actually think like the Figma Adobe thing is kind of a big deal here because that's all about like manipulating images and UIs and design flows. And then you have this like software system that can generate anything you can possibly imagine. And it's not a huge leap of faith to think that tools like Stable Diffusion and others that might come out of it that, you know, companies like Runway and others have been working on could like fundamentally rethink what Figma was doing. And so it's like, wow, there's a real enterprise software use case to this. I can also, as an investor, apply some of my consumer DNA to this because it feels a bit more like up my alley than some, you know, deep, dark like data infrastructure product that is quite esoteric in a way that, yeah, consumer machine learning isn't. And yeah, I think after that open source movement from Stability that precipitated, yeah, some people would call it basically an arms race in AI, you know, which has pros and cons to it. And others would just call it sort of an unlocking of potential, really, that was previously just gatekept by a couple of big technology companies and major research labs in the US and you know, in the UK. Meanwhile, you know, so many people and engineers and developers want to have these capabilities at their fingertips to apply in everyday software And so it was sort of a rise of the rest outside of the ivory towers, I think.
But I was wondering, just maybe to touch upon the deal with Figma and Adobe, it also kind of seems that there are all this software and also maybe AI helps quite a bit to help teams become more creative. I see it like in the audio, video, design space, whereas like maybe some 5 years ago, you need different type of tools, very expensive software to do any type of manipulation. Whereas like now, anyone can do it. I just signed up, I think like 2 days ago for a professional headshot. You just give them like 10-20 pictures and they will give you better headshots that any professional photographer could do. And you see the same like with audio editing, video editing, and so on and so forth. What do you think is like the connection? Is there any connection, or just because I'm a creator, I see that connection between being more creative and having easy to use tools?
I think it's the maturation cycle of advanced technology, where it's oftentimes starts in more research settings on benchmarks and kind of toy problems. And then, you know, as it matures and becomes more capable, individuals in, you know, the sort of real world outside of academia who have a much higher bar for, is this usable? Does this solve my problem? Is it intuitive? You know, then can cross that chasm and say like, yeah, I'm going to start paying attention to this because I click a button and it just kind of works. So I think it's a really healthy sign. And I think an example of how general purpose this technology is, it's often been called like a general purpose technology. I think that's truly the case. I think, yeah, like you, I mean, I've been blown away with some capabilities. I think the one that illustrates it really nicely for me about how sometimes you have a machine learning capability and on itself, you know, that might be a startup and you're like, I don't know how this could by itself be a really big startup, but it could be integrated in someone else's tool and become really big. And for that, the case study I have is Descript, the, you know, podcasting audio editing tool, which I think is just like a really fun, simple experience to edit audio. And they acquired this small startup in Canada called Lyrebird, which was one of the early ones doing voice cloning. Like these videos, you know, Obama saying things and various characters saying whatever you want, etc. It looks cool, gimmicky, whatever. But in Descript, the use case was so cool. It was like, I said a couple of things. I didn't mean that. I want to say something else. Just delete the words, put new words, and the system generates it for you. And that's like just magic. So applied to other cases, I think it's like sort of magic editing wand is what everybody wants. Which maybe gets into like the second point we can talk about around how I think a lot of like software up till today has been designed in this idea that a user wants to solve an overall objective, but the software has to sort of break apart that objective into several subtasks. Some of those subtasks can be machine learned, so a lot of them can't. And therefore, they're just replaced with a UI that you kind of click and do things with as a person. And now with generative capabilities, probably a lot of those tasks, we can just rip them out of the UI and get the model to do it instead.
Is it like also now the opposite, that you don't necessarily to know how to build the code, but you know, you kind of have the feel what it needs to look like and the function of it, and you kind of, as we've seen, you just draw it on a napkin, and then like in the back end, it just builds like the whole application.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that's another way of putting this. Like just give the system your design constraints and your overall objective without needing to know exactly how to get there, and then basically you're like really limited by your creativity, not by your capability to engineer, which is a huge unlock, I think, on like human potential, basically. It's like a real way that we can accelerate creating more software in areas that don't have it and, you know, really liberate people's creativity.
And if we take a step back, you've been focusing on AI for quite some years. I was wondering if you can tell us the story of you founding Air Street Capital and what was the motivation behind it?
So I went to graduate school in biology and bioinformatics. I'm doing cancer research, basically in this time span between 2010 and 2013, when you know, life sciences and biology was starting to become a domain with lots of data. So we had experiments sequencing lots of genomes, experiments that read out the expression of different genes for different diseases, lots of imaging data, etc. And it was really becoming like a quantitative science. And as a result of that, lots of tools were developed that applied statistics and machine learning to parse that information, make sense of it, etc. Through that experience, basically encountered like, wow, there are these new tools and they make your life a lot easier when you're trying to deconvolve really complex things that you might not necessarily have objectively the sort of knowledge of the rules of the game. So the software can learn the rules of the game from data. And when I finished in 2013, I was in Cambridge. I moved down to London, and I was really excited about working on this translation of new technology, new kind of ideas into products that matter to a lot of people. And certainly, like, biology matters to basically everyone. And I wanted to find something quite similar. And in many ways, I think software and technology has that, like, scale impact and has been, like, over generations shown to be a great vehicle to kind of commercialize and make sense of new tech. That's kind of when I joined the VC industry in 2013 in London, which was, like, markedly different to what it's like today. I wouldn't say it was particularly, like, open and receptive to new joiners from science and engineering backgrounds. It was really like, you know, do you have a background in banking or trading or finance or consulting? And if not, then why are you here? Kind of vibe. So that was pretty hard. And I did 4 years at a firm in London, which is basically a family office. Then I moved to another firm in Berlin called Point Nine, more established SaaS and marketplace fund. That was a fantastic time. And basically over that sort of 2013 to 2017 and 19 window, machine learning, the first wave of machine learning, like in the modern era of deep learning, kind of really came online. You know, DeepMind was acquired. Many companies were starting to build data science practices internally. ImageNet, this visual competition was solved that gave rise to, you know, several large computer vision enterprise SaaS companies and some big M&As. All the big tech companies were hiring AI folks and building labs in 2016, 17. And, you know, even though all these things were happening, the VC ecosystem in London was, like, getting more, and in Europe more generally, was getting more evolved, but still was very anchored on catering to consumer internet, marketplace, enterprise software, entrepreneurs, and nothing more than that, really. I would say there were some firms that were quote-unquote deep tech, which were very, like, anchored around, you know, university ecosystems and IP and filing patents. But then those shops lacked the commercial acumen of, like, we actually need to build products and software and sell things. I thought just like there was a big, like, market need, particularly in machine learning, because given how fast it evolves, given that there wasn't really playbooks and networks and community and benchmarks and languages and all the rest of it that SaaS benefited from. So we needed to build that for AI, because I thought then, and I increasingly think now, that it's the most powerful lever on tech progress quite broadly. And the playbooks are getting written all the time at the moment. And so the space deserves a firm that's created, like, natively for it, and that's stylized as being a core contributor to the overall AI project that we're all working on, but just makes core contributions of a different nature than pure code. So that's what I sort of, like, refined as a view over the years, and it's basically the role that Air functions today. And yeah, I'd say it's still very much like day one.
You're quite deep into the space, and also your thinking evolved, and you've watched very closely the industry as the industry has evolved, and you are co-authoring the State of AI report. It's an in-depth report of about 100 pages long across research. Then you look at industry, politics, and safety. I highly recommend to our listeners to have a look. I will link it in the show notes. So on that report, I have like a two-part question. What are the highlights worth mentioning across research and industry? And maybe on the politics side, you mentioned that the gap between academia and industry is just, like, it's too wide to be able to bridge it again. Like, is it anything that can be done, or is it, like, too late? And what does that mean for the ecosystem?
So on the research side, what really was interesting is in sort of 2020 or so, maybe even 2019, there was this kind of breakthrough moment when these transformer models, which are effectively models that can learn from very, very long sequences and effectively learn to make next word predictions or next token predictions. And token could just be increasingly arbitrarily anything. That paper originally came out in 2017 and it was built for machine translation. And then by 2019, 2020, it started to have breakthrough results on various kinds of natural language tasks. And then we thought, okay, the next thing, that next kind of data domain that transformers would kind of blitz everything else is going to be computer vision. And then that happened. And then since then, in, like, 2020, 2021, transformers sort of eaten more and more data modalities, whether it's video or 3D point clouds, which are used for reconstructing 3D scenes.
And how does this work? So a transformer just takes massive amount of data from a data set and then is able with a certain type of accuracy to predict or to reconstruct a question based on all the data. And slowly these transformers can be trained in video and in different type of data sets and have still a pretty good accuracy. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, effectively, it's sort of this like simple notion that if you can transform a data modality, whether it's video or text or audio, into a sequence, and you have enough sequences, and these are like, you know, billions or trillions of examples, you don't even need to really label like what that sequence is about effectively in the way that you had to do labeling for prior models. But there is like implicit knowledge and statistics and structure in the way that audio is laid out and the way the words are laid out, because humans like inject it in there because some things sound good and some things sound bad or read well or read bad. And a model can learn those statistics at scale. So it's this weirdly, like, you know, beautifully simple idea. And the key thing with transformers is also this idea of self-attention, which is, you know, where in the past do I need to focus in order to make the best future prediction? Because in language, I might be, you know, the next few words might relate to something I said a few paragraphs ago, or might be related to what I said, you know, a few words ago. And so figuring that out is also very important. And I think the other thing that's really nice with this transformer architecture, it kind of illustrates a bit of how machine learning evolves, is that oftentimes it works in one domain and then it diffuses quite rapidly into entirely different domains without too much modification. And so, you know, we mentioned that it started in translation NLP and then moved to video, but it also was really useful for DeepMind in predicting 3D structure of proteins from amino acid sequences, which are, you know, a different kind of language, if you will, but still like a very simple representation of like a very complicated 3D, minuscule, wiggly structure, squidgy structure that interacts with lots of different other squidgy things in liquids all the time. So it's kind of wild that it works, is my TLDR.
I remember having this debate with a friend a couple of years ago. My side of the argument was you can definitely replicate a human being if you would look very granular at all the steps and everything that that human being has done over a lifetime, and maybe you can look at different human beings. It kind of seems right now that we're very close, if not, we're almost here in being able to replicate a human mind.
Yeah, I think it's tough because that's like where neuroscience really comes into play. And I think it invokes this idea of, do you have to understand how something works in order to build it? And I don't think we really understand fully neuroscience and how it works. Is that going to be a gatekeeper to building something artificial? I don't know. But in some ways, you know, we have many medicines today that people consume all the time that we don't actually really totally understand how they work mechanistically. And that's fine because we can measure the end output. I would say the learning so far, if you buy that, you know, bigger and bigger models yield, again, like unpredictable, quote unquote, emergent behaviors, and more data is also the path, then, you know, we might not need to encode a lot of these priors, which are basically some form of like rules and understanding of the brain and derived from neuroscience in order to get to more performant models. So it looks at the moment sort of that neuroscience doesn't really matter as much, but who knows if we hit a roadblock, who knows what lies ahead. Maybe the other thing I'll point out here, which is a bit of a counter argument to that, is there is some neat examples that, you know, these large like GPT style models can perform better if you ask them to explain their reasoning or to think step by step. This is one of the interesting papers that came out in the last like year or two. And so instead of kind of training them to do goal oriented learning, which is just like solve this problem, I don't kind of care how you get there, you can do process-oriented learning, which is like learn the principles and the steps that are required to solve this overall problem, with the view that if you can do it in that sequential behavior, then you're going to learn like useful sub-behaviors, you know, whether that's like moral principles or methods of problem solving, which are therefore might give rise to a more robust and reliable, steerable general purpose agent.
What do you think is the role of academia here, but then also maybe the role of governments? Should they try to help the industry in particular, I guess, also in Europe? And also, I know that also you're the founder of Spinouts, where you probably you saw the problem that there is this gap between academia and industry.
So I think, you know, research plays like a really important role. Universities play a really important role for the very basic reason that, you know, they're educating future generations that will be contributing to this technology and, you know, every industry on the planet. The reality right now is unfortunately that universities don't really provide a compelling counter proposition to large industrial labs and well-funded startups for individuals who want to pursue frontier research, which is at the moment still very like compute constrained, resource constrained, data constrained, et cetera, without wanting to be buried under lots of paperwork and administration and teaching and grant writing and be compensated to some degree of market rate. And I say to some degree because the chasm is just so vast, both because academia is very underpaid and large industrial labs are very overpaid. So that's like a big problem. And so in the State of AI report as well, like in the last couple of years, we've just been documenting this like great AI brain drain, which, you know, started with a lot of brand name professors that were having dual appointments between universities and industrial labs, and then sometimes just leaving altogether. And then increasingly students that were going more towards industry rather than research. And yeah, played over a long period of time. I think that sort of like guts the core engine that creates the intellectual capital that we need to sustain industry and to sustain research settings that will teach future generations. So I think that's a big problem. And then I would say on the nation state side, also, you know, we saw the last couple of years that AI has been a core part of geopolitics. Like it's almost the soft power nowadays, particularly with compute infrastructure requirements and availability. You know, nation states that make resources available and, you know, lean into positive regulation and enablement and, you know, really want to get clued up on what's going on AI and how that might impact things like regulation, data privacy, but also principles of like safe development and safe use, I think will be warmly welcomed by the AI community. And you can see that over the last couple of weeks with, you know, pretty marked uptake and people talking about the importance of AI safety and alignment, which, by the way, like 2 years ago when we started talking about this topic in the State of AI report and did some primary research to document how many individual researchers were actively involved like solely on AI alignment research in big industrial labs and counted it quite generously to 100 people. We got a lot of flack for that. And it seems like the tide has been changing quite significantly and obviously still has a long way to go because of the, you know, chasm between investing and making these things better versus like making them controllable, steerable, safe, reliable, just like you would want any important software system that controls something quite significant in your life or in the economy to do. This is just like good practices, I think. And then like, I think finally on that note of Spinouts, I think, you know, now like for, you know, for better or for worse, I think largely for worse, the world heads to nationalism over globalization. You know, now nation states want to have sovereignty increasingly over, you know, key technologies that will enable them to be competitive and self-sufficient in the future. And that's almost certainly AI, compute, you know, biomanufacturing, energy. And, you know, my contention with Spinouts and why it's so important for nation states to be involved and set permissive policy is that companies that and technologies that will emerge in these domains in which they want sovereignty are most likely going to be derived and created directly from or immediately adjacent to university environments. And so it's not sufficient to just focus on, you know, investing in late stage companies or, you know, trying to make it attractive for big companies to set up offices in your country, et cetera. You need to truly enable the formation of companies out of inventions in these key areas from the get-go in universities. So it's the discussion no longer becomes like, oh, should a founder part ways with 20% or 5%? Like, am I getting my fair share? It's like, no, this is national level priority stuff. This is way more than, you know, a few individuals in a tech transfer office debating on what's fair. You know, I think we're past that at this point. And it seems like we're, you know, making some progress after, you know, crowdsourcing what's now over 200 individual spin-out deals across 100 universities in the world to provide a bit of a global view on just how much disparity there is between different countries and which ones perform better or worse. And to be honest, ultimately, what do the most ambitious entrepreneurial founders want? And if you give them a product they don't like, then nothing might happen today, but in 5-10 years you'll experience the ramifications, and I don't think it's fixable at that point.
And you're investing in AI first technology and life science companies. Let's focus on the AI first. What does an AI first tech startup look like? There are a lot of startups right now trying to rebrand and adding AI capabilities.
Yeah, so for me, this notion of AI first just means that the product or service that you're delivering to a customer is uniquely enabled by machine learning. If you were to rip out that component, the product would basically fall over, the customer wouldn't buy it because the value prop wouldn't be there anymore. And so I try really to focus on companies that wouldn't exist if it's not for the machine learning. And therefore that brings me into domains which are traditionally not tractable for web app plus database and SaaS or marketplace or consumer internet. So what comes with being AI first is this ability to identify a problem space which has like very clear benchmarks on what good looks like, what a professional would say this is good enough or not good enough. In the example of like audio that we talked about earlier, I think there it's quite easy. It's like, yeah, I would use this. No, I wouldn't use this. Here's like a string of audio that I would like to process. Can you clearly show to me that your machine learned like editing tool is going to satisfy my requirements? And in some cases, there are like some clear numerical metrics there that you can assess. Oftentimes, it's then like tying whatever this model can do to ROI, so that there's like a very clear return on investment, which relates to, I think, the most important point, which is that, if you're developing a machine learning system that outputs predictions and those predictions are somehow being used to edit audio or make trades or predict unsafe events in industrial facilities, you want to tie your business model as closely to the value of the predictions that you're making. With that, in most of these AI first companies I invest into, I'm looking for full stack companies. So ones that don't just kind of take a model capability, wrap it in an API and say anybody can use it however you want. Because there you don't have very much price discrimination between somebody who's using it to like detect hot dogs and someone who's using it like design new drugs or rank which molecules might be the most potent. And so very much focused on like owning the value of your predictions. And I think this is increasingly important in the generative era when the model by nature is much more general purpose than prior machine learning where you're categorizing things or ranking things or recommending things. It's not like a huge diversity from a monetary value point of view, tasks that you can do with that discriminative machine learning, but we're generative when it's like a student essay or like Bridgewater making, trades on Wall Street. The diversity of value creation is vast. And so I think they're having like a full stack solution that caters properly to the user persona, the workflow, and everything is even more important.
And what does a successful AI startup look like? Does it have like a scientific founding team and a commercial co-founder? Is it as the intersection of large language models and new unique data set? Is it IP?
It's always hard to like reduce these things, but I think the Venn diagram overlap I've learned over the years is like you want teams to be incredibly technically capable so that they can, pull whatever tools are available on the shelf, customize them or build new components, do whatever they need to in order to like create a product, and then at the same time be insanely commercially focused so that they can really scope what is the problem truly that the customer is solving, why does it exist, like how does it make them feel, how should the solution look like, do they get promoted for using this tool or not, like how does it impact their KPIs, and then ultimately like that Venn diagram is to overlap such that a team is not only technically capable, very commercially focused, but extremely pragmatic about using whatever it takes to solve the problem. Which I think in this current era of like generative AI is a bit tough because everybody is like running with a ginormous, expensive to run language model, which shows impressive capabilities out of the box, but ultimately might not be the right tool to solve like this huge long tail of problems that are out there that might be better suited for a different approach altogether or a more simple model. So on the technical capability side, I think I prefer it if individuals on the founding team have some machine learning capabilities or some understanding of how these systems work at a lower level, because I think it is important. Might not be important at the demo stage, but when you get bigger and you need to do a lot of like system level optimization and distributed computing and all that stuff, like it pays to understand how this stuff works. Yeah. But also that they show immense like curiosity and drive to ultimately serve a customer, and that they're not going to, especially on like the PhD side, that they're not going to feel like they're sort of wasting their time if they're not using like this like super sexy method that they developed in their PhD. And I'll add one anecdote of like a similar team like this that I invested in, which was, you know, three PhDs that published great papers in natural language processing, et cetera, like all this sexy stuff. And then like 2 years in, they've built like a proper enterprise software company. And, you know, this always like new papers that come out. And I sent one of these papers to the CEO, who was one of these, you know, well-published academics. I said, hey, what do you think about this new architecture, these benchmarks? And he was basically like, I don't know, man, like I just do sales. So I saw that text. I was like, damn, this guy's good. This is what I want to see. So yeah, like I think that illustrates the arc, you know, where it's at the very early stage companies, you know, trying to navigate this complex maze of what do I want to build with this general purpose technology? What am I excited about? Where's the problem space, et cetera. It's a lot of AI esotericness. And then if the company is successful by A or B, it just becomes like an enterprise software company. And if you want to read about the AI, you can just go on the company's website /research or something and then read about it. But that's ultimately not like what they're leaning into the market with.
Let's change gears a little bit and let's get personal. What's the moment of pleasure for you as an investor? Is it when you meet an exciting team, when you work together with the team, when you see them scale? What's the moment of pleasure for you?
Yeah, I think there's these rare moments of meeting a team where it almost feels like love at first sight, where you're like, you know, these individuals have just thought so deeply and like so 360 about this problem space that you're learning something new. You feel that they're this sponge, that they want to get better, that you can, you know, feed in some insight. And then the next time you meet them, it's like, you know, they sort of like skip the level. I think that's very, very fulfilling. And you feel almost that you would, you know, mortgage your house to back these people because you think they're going to be there on the NASDAQ at some point. And, you know, if I do my job well, I'll get invited to that party. That's like probably my metric of success, you know, because I think that like does like a dimensionality reduction on everything that happens between when you invest and when the company succeeds. And I would say I also just get a lot of fulfillment from seeing other people succeed. I think it's just like an amazing spot to be in, to be like, you know, a node in this overall network where, you know, like we continue to host a lot of community events, and I see some students that come to those events, and then now they're inspired to like work in machine learning, and then they start taking coding boot camps, and then the next year they find an internship at some company that presented, and the next year they're like a full-time employee, and then after that they start a company and they say, hey, do you want to chat? Like, I just think like seeing these arcs of progress is just so fulfilling and so like rewarding. And I just, yeah, try and think like every day if there's some very high leverage activities that I can work on, whether it's, you know, Rise, London AI, or Spin Outs, or State of AI, that, you know, make a core contribution that, you know, 10 years on, I can feel like that really made a difference, or that I can be proud of.
And what do you attribute your success to? You're seen as a thought leader in the space, actively investing in amazing startups. What do you attribute your success to?
I would say perpetual curiosity. Like I don't stylize myself as a finance person. I don't think I ever actually took like a finance class per se. I'm really, you know, somebody who just deeply is interested and wants to advance like the frontier in science and technology and make and turn that into products that really matter, on problems that really matter. Everything I do is to try and like portray that, and everything I do is very genuine to my interests. So there's no like kind of PR department that's saying like the company has to say this or has to say that. And I think I like that freedom of speech and expression. And then I think just like, you know, persistence pays off. I mean, one of the things I learned like when I was in school is basically just no is not an answer. Mm-hmm. Like you either didn't ask the right question or you should try again.
Interesting, I like that. And I know that you have to jump off. So the last question is like, if Nathan from 10 years ago would listen to this episode, what would you tell him?
I think I would just do it all over again. It's hard to say like I would do this differently or that differently, because who knows how the future would unfold. But I think like trust in the process and like follow what you're most excited about and your intellectual curiosity. And I think ultimately, like, I've never been a believer for, you know, do this because you want to end there. I think it's like always pursue what you're most excited about and always put yourself in a spot where you can learn the most. And if you don't feel like that's the case anymore, go find a steeper learning curve.
Follow your curiosity and excitement. Wonderful. Nathan, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time. This was a pleasure.
Yeah, no, it was a real pleasure. For sure. Me too. Thanks.